Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to WPR Rebuttal, covering the sides of the story missed by Wisconsin Public Radio, bringing you narratives the UW System Board of Regents won't allow, and shedding light on perspectives the owners of WPR don't want you to hear. So just a quick recap of where we've been in recent episodes. Well, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the Board of Regents meeting June 9th and 10th at UW-Milwaukee, and yours truly composed a few template letters that readers and callers, readers of our blog and listeners of our podcast who sometimes call in, they sent a bunch of these support letters about the Regents maintaining Ray Cross as UW System President, so he can continue his groundbreaking work on reforming the UW system. Now, that was quite the coup because at first, even I was skeptical of Ray Cross, but time has proven him to be an actual reformer who wants to do things to hold various members of the UW accountable. And eventually, he'll get around to school of work outcomes, I'm sure, because that's the trajectory where the UW system accountability movement is headed. Don't bet money because I'm not a gambling person, and I wouldn't want to risk anyone losing money on this like they would losing money on a UW system degree. But I'm pretty certain that with tenure coming under the sights of accountability, then in the near future we'll also have legislation and regulations relating to documenting school of work outcomes so that those campuses that have programs that are doing well enough to advertise themselves, okay, as like a professional program where you're supposed to be able to get internships, and those programs that offer internships, they aren't doing well enough for their students where enough of their graduates are getting absorbed into the professional labor market instead of just the workaday dead-end like GED holder labor market, then those programs with poor performance overall ought to be canceled. And then WPR Rebeau covered UW-Madison student protester Denzel McDonald and how he is not really a first-time offender because according to the Department of Justice background check, he actually has from June 24th, 2015, he was convicted already of UWS 18.12 parentheses 8, and that, of course, is vandalism on UW lands. So in other words, strictly speaking, Denzel McDonald is not a first-time offender. The fact that he was already convicted for vandalism on UW lands before he was charged anew means that the district attorney was just way too lenient with him. And I made one update to the blog article accompanying that podcast, and it's a parody of a comic panel from Amazing Spider-Man number 361, and it's the one where it has a depiction of the message "Carnage Rules" on the wall of this ruined building. And what I did is I used an old edition of Photoshop, because the new ones just are poor, and they're mostly software as a service. So I have one of the few versions of Photoshop that you can still keep on your hard drive without paying a renewal every year. And I went and used that to go and create, let's just say, a graffiti tag over parts of that comic panel. So where it says Carnage Rules, I struck it out with brighter red paint. Of course, it's being just digitally by pixels to make it appear as if the comic artist had drawn this as well. And I manipulated the light gradient, too, to make it look more native to the comic panel. But so Carnage is crossed out, and then it's the word rules. And then up top of the first part that's crossed out is the graffiti scrawl King Shabazz. And it's at about more or less the same angle at which the original comic panel had that graffiti. And so that was at, like, not quite a 45-degree angle, but it was definitely at an acute angle relative to the ground in that, depicted in that column panel. So, in other words, I made it appear as if someone crossed out the first part of Carnage Rules and wrote King Shabazz, because really the style of the graffiti is pretty similar to what was photographed by Yale Madison police. So that was me, Senator JPO, doing that faithful rendition of Denzel McDonald's graffiti in that digital comic panel. No buildings were hurt or tagged in the making of that parody, which is a lot more than what can be said for Denzel McDonald. That guy is able to make anything of his UW degree in the labor market, and he should be very thankful, because really, no one really wants to hire a punk, and the fact that McDonald has not even apologized publicly tends to portray him as a punk. So if the callers don't like that comment about Denzel McDonald being a punk, you can call in 929-477-3965. The UW-Madison students who supported Denzel, finals finished a few weeks ago. He had commencement. If you want to call in and go and try to defend your folk hero, Denzel King Shabazz McDonald, call in at 929-477-3965. But really, most of these Madison students are probably getting stoned or whatever. Gosh. And the irony is, because it's UW Madison, at least in decades past, that would have gone and still given them the halo effect, right? But now times are changing. UW Madison is not as revered as it used to be, at the very least, not in the labor market. So all you UW Madison slackers, you think, oh, I'm going to just have the world at my feet because I'm at UW freaking Madison. Well, think again. Your flagship is sinking like the Titanic. So keep that in mind. You have to go and get some real work experience. So work your tail off this summer, at the very least, if not to get into a career. I mean, if you can get into a professionally related job, then that's the best situation. But if you can't, then still keep working as close to full time as you can get hours this summer, because you'll need to save that money. Yeah, you'll need to save that money, because when you graduate, there will be nothing for you. If you're a student worker especially, you won't get any unemployment benefits, and that really stinks. So I mentioned earlier that Denzel McDonald was convicted already in June 2015, a whole year before his recent conviction for UWS Chapter 18. Misconduct on UW lands. Well, the statute that prohibits unemployment benefits for certain classes of workers, including student employees, is 108.02. So you can go and write your legislators to tell them, hey, strike out 108.02 to give unemployment benefits to all types of workers. Now, if you think, well, some workers still shouldn't have unemployment benefits, then at the very least tell legislators, given the student need to go and have this extra money to go and, like, migrate for work. Because, you know, unlike foreign labor, the students' housing and transportation are not paid by the employer if they're this jobless jabroni going about and seeking work. You know, so the whole move for work thing just makes you into an okie, so to speak, who's not guaranteed anything. Or these migrant laborers who are recruited by foreign brokers, oh, they're guaranteed a job. All they do is they come along on this employer-paid bus. They stay in this employer-paid housing. And, it's a job for them, but not for these highly educated college grads who sacrifice, you know, years of their lives in this tuition. Oh, and were they getting any sympathy 2 years ago? No. Like, well, if they were dumb enough to go and take out a student loan, then it doesn't matter how smart they are. They can get in the best university, but they're just still a stupid ass that they don't have enough common sense to realize that, you know, the people don't like them enough only to go in front of jobs. But now that's changing. Now there's enough of these students who were previously seen as rubes, okay? There's enough of these disgruntled grads where now they are a political force, and the UW system is finding that out the hard way. And now the tenure is getting taken apart as a direct consequence of these unfortunate grads who are now making the faculty feel less fortunate. Okay, so there was an adrenaline rush going on, and about the UW system's steady demise, and it's lawful. It's a paper demise, okay? In other words, I find that so-called paper demises have greater occupational and economic consequences for an entire group of people than do, like, certain people who go and they're trying to solve problems with violence. No, no. Solving problems with regulations, as I am doing, is a superior solution because regulations and their effects last longer on an institution than any act of violence ever could. So if you want a revolution against the UW system, put away your weapons, or at least in the traditional sense. Instead, just become lobbyists and go and get the legislators to go and burden the UW system with onerous accountability measures. That's all you need to do, and it works. I mean, look at the past year or so. That's living proof that it works. Or did I say year? Look at the past 18 months. The past 18 months, the past year and a half. You know, first we succeed in getting the UW system budget cut, and there might be future cuts for next biennium. We'll see how the legislators are doing politically. But we're heading towards greater leverage towards the student consumers, greater leverage towards the taxpayer. So, yes, there is a sea change within this university, and it is also transpire at other state universities. But again, to keep track of all that is beyond a normal human. So we need a team, and WPR Rebel is a one-man operation. So going on to the title of today's podcast, having recapped all that delicious information, jobs with adrenaline, because what has that to do with the podcast? What has that to do with the UW system? Well, very simple fact is that when you end up underemployed, chances are it's going to be in some type of manual labor. And many of these manual labor positions are rather difficult, at least at first. They get the adrenaline pumping. That's the common denominator, is these physically demanding menial labor jobs. And a lot of these underemployed college graduates are hanging up in them. So it would tend to mean that maybe you'll have more people. Well, it depends. Like, some people would say you have more people wanting a higher minimum wage, but that's not the case with me because I already earn, in my manual labor job, I've earned enough raises now over the past 18 months to, yet no joke, to get 40% higher than the minimum wage in Wisconsin. Yes. So I'm already doing well just by staying with this one job through an agency, okay? So if you people are stuck at, like, McDonald's or something and you're still getting close to minimum wage, ditch McDonald's after a staffing agency has placed you into a job. The jobs into which staffing agencies place mostly pay above the minimum wage, at least by a few dollars. And if you stay at that agency long enough and you just take the initiative like I did and point out after a year or so, hey, I've been doing this for a year, error-free, 100% punctuality, and chances are they will agree. The agency that doesn't agree, well, you go to another employer then. That's the whole point of the agency. It's supposed to be a springboard, if not to a better position, then at least a springboard to better wages at your same position, which the agency has initially assigned you. And it should be going where the agency, if they cut off your first assignment, but you have perfect record of performance and punctuality, they should give you a follow-up assignment. And in my case, I've been fortunate to have the same assignment now for 18 months. So, no new learning curve, just keeping tabs on what changes at the one place where I work. And I won't name it because I respect the privacy of my employer, and they reward me quite handily with the aforementioned raises. But, so what is the nature of what I actually do? Well, without getting into the nitty-gritty details that would permit identification of an employer, I stack stuff and then wrap it up. So the stacking and unitizing collectively are known as palletizing. Now, I'm grateful that this job is not always the fastest pace because the pace depends on, of course, mostly the rate of production, which in turn is determined by the machinery. And the machinery has bottlenecks, and you cannot go any faster than that current machinery allows. And this actually helps maximize labor, because if the machinery has a hard ceiling on performance in production, then the labor will have to wait for the machinery to go and just like accrue certain amounts to warrant then another action of like scooping material into hoppers if it's loose, or in stacking if it's already bundled, and so on. Just some distinctions here. Like you might hear of people like coal miners scooping coal into a hopper. Well, that's because that type of bin, like on a railroad cart, a hopper is designed to hold loose material, such as sediment, coal. Theoretically speaking, it could be designed to also hold wrapped candy too. Of course, if you just they get the proper food safety compliance, you would have to modify the design to have like the entire surface of the hopper, at least the inside of it, coated in some type of self-replenishing sanitizer fluid. But the hopper is designed to hold stuff that is not packaged together, because for the most part, the stuff is of different sizes, and it'd be difficult to go and pack all these grains or nodules of irregularly shaped materials into uniformly shaped boxes. So you put these irregularly shaped materials into the hopper, and then when you have a full mine cart or what have you, then you go and, used to actually pull up the tram by manually pumping this lever. But now they have all automatic trams and coal mines, even though they're still rather dangerous because you have all this dust, so you have to wear a respirator all the times in the coal mine, because that's needed to prevent the black lung disease, wherein a bunch of coal dust accumulates in the lungs faster than the lungs are able to clean themselves. So, of course, coal mining is a rough job because not only that, but also just the danger beyond the strenuous effort. Some palletizing jobs, like at a lumber mill, you don't so much palletize as you just throw the stuff onto the conveyor. You're inspecting the wood, and you're throwing it onto the conveyor, which goes to the sawmill. And that is very rough because you have to not only throw the stuff onto the conveyor belt, but also inspect it to make sure it's not rotten. And you have to keep the pace because the sawmill just cuts right through everything. There's no real fancy process on a sawmill, whereas the stuff that you palletize, much more has to be accurately calibrated to hold the flaps on a box and to tape them together and make sure that stuff is weighed. Whereas with the lumber mill, it's mostly saw and weigh, and that's all there is to it. It's like once you have a certain weight inside the lumber truck, then you drive it off, and then you put another one in. And then, like, more adrenaline-inducing jobs. Oh, boy. Okay, so pretty much tied with sawmill. Actually, even according to workers' compensation rates I found online, now, where in the world do you find the workers' compensation premiums average for each state? Well, I actually found this on Department of Workforce Development. You have to go through a bunch of links, like DWD for employers, and then go to workers' compensation, and then they'll have the premium tables, as they call it. And no joke, like workers' compensation premiums for foundry workers, at least in a Ferrous foundry, F-E-R-R-O-U-S, that's a foundry of anything containing iron. Well, in an iron foundry, that's the highest premium of workers in most states, including Wisconsin. And it approaches nearly $20 in Wisconsin and exceeds that in many of our Midwestern states. So that's how you know that iron foundry worker is the most dangerous position. And why is that? Well, besides the other hazards of a non-iron foundry, like oh, let's say, an aluminum foundry, right? Well, aluminum materials tend to be lighter weight. And, you know, all metal that's formed with edges, all that are sharp too, and it gets hot, but that's why the employer is supposed to give you these thick, heat-resistant gloves. Even then, it can be very tough to avoid getting burnt. And you have a trade-off in the foundry, okay? This is what makes it so dangerous. You have a trade-off between quickly handling the material to minimize your surface contact and burns with the product, but you also have to make sure that you handle the product carefully enough and with enough agility to avoid getting cut, to avoid dropping it on yourself, or avoid just ruining the product somehow by denting it if it's still hot. And that's the tough part of a foundry, is that it's a constant balance on every single piece you grab between precision and quickness. If you're too precise, then you might take too long in holding it, and the heat from all these pieces of the metal, if you don't wait long enough between pieces, and sometimes you can't, and then the heat will build up and exceed the thermal rating of the gloves, and you'll be burnt. And that really stinks, because on a constant rate production line, there's very little choice but either keep pace with the rate or get burnt, in which case it's like an OSHA issue, and you have to talk about maybe getting workers to alternate the handling of the material so that your gloves have longer to cool off. And again, this is WPR Rebuttal. We're talking about adrenaline-inducing jobs. I call it Jobs with Adrenaline in our title. If you want to call in, we have 8 minutes remaining. 929-477-3965. If you are on lunch break at a really tough job, let us know. 929-477-3965. Okay, so now I just finished off with Jobs with Adrenaline. If we have any callers, we'll jump back to that segment. But I had a work-related dream. Yes, this very morning, Monday, June 13th, 2016. And that is, I was inside a thrift store, and at first I thought maybe I was in there to buy stuff. But then I noticed this U-shaped conveyor belt, which roughly mirrors the conveyor belt I had in my workplace. But instead of what I usually palletize, there was a bunch of food on that conveyor belt. Actually, specifically speaking, there was all these cases of ramen noodles. And I'm like, wow, is this for a food pantry? And why is it on a U-shaped conveyor belt in a thrift store? It's so odd. Shouldn't it be like at a loading dock for a grocery store, if it's going to be a food product and be shipped to a food pantry, then wouldn't a grocery store be a more appropriate setting than the middle of a thrift store? So it was obviously a somewhat strange dream, but continuing on, and all the stuff is already backed up on the U-shaped conveyor belt. And at the very front is like, futon mattresses. So I have to clear the front of the conveyor belt. There's three futon mattresses. And I tacitly realize that I'm actually a porter working on that conveyor line, and I'm getting back from my lunch break. That's why I had been walking leisurely. And then I round this corner. I get around this line of clothing racks, and I see that U-shaped conveyor belt is getting backed up. It has like three futons at the head. And must be 5 or 6 feet away from the futons. You know, there's empty space behind it. Before 5 or 6 feet behind that is a bunch of ramen noodle cases. And another one is on its way, and it's getting backed up because there's more friction on that conveyor belt from all these cases of ramen noodles. By my count and recollection, there must have been maybe 18 to 20 on that U-shaped conveyor belt. So it wasn't a real long conveyor belt by any means, but there were enough of these big cases of ramen noodles. They're like, the case was like orange. I think it was one of those generic ramen noodles, but it had orange film on each case, and I recall the number 12. So there were about a dozen, exactly rather, dozen cases of ramen noodles for each of these Frischi's case. What I'm saying is, you know, not a dozen of those individual, yeah, a dozen servings. That's what I mean. There are a dozen servings of these for each case. And if one serving of ramen is like half a pound, so then they're like 6 pounds for each case. And when you add up the coefficient of friction of the conveyor belt, which I don't know what that is because I didn't have a chance to go and feel the conveyor belt and compare that what I felt on the friction to a chart of known friction coefficients. But the whole bottom line is that based on observation within that dream, there's so much ramen on there. And you can multiply the 6 pounds by 20. So really, you have the 180 pounds, the size of like an adult, really, pushing against that conveyor belt. So it was about to back up because the conveyor like that, based on the type of stuff that it's handling, it's only designed to handle maybe up to 200 pounds. So that breaking point was coming real soon on the conveyor belt workload. So I'm getting these food towns out of the way that they're too big to fit in the conveyor, so someone must have just laid the food towns there at this counter or this elevated platform that's at the end of the conveyor. So who knows who had put these futons over there, and we need the room to make way for these cases of ramen noodles that are coming down the conveyor. And, okay, so I see this like, oh, man. On one hand, it looked like a cabinet because it didn't have any wheels, noticeable wheels. But on the other hand, I thought, well, it's probably some type of transport truck or something. So that's the odd part of the dream is that the vehicle in which I was to place the futons in the ramen was not explicitly clear. So I'm thinking, where do I put this stuff? It's going down the conveyor. Where do I put it? And there's no pallets or anything, not a wooden skid in which to place anything. So I'm thinking where to put everything. And then I awoke because I realized that if it had been a genuine job, then there would be some type of designated spot in which to place the things. There'd be a more logical workflow other than just a conveyor belt full of ramen noodles in the middle of a thrift store. And that was a mixture of various types of experiences. One, the ramen noodles represent want and hunger and poverty. And you have a lot of poverty on the conveyor belt, which represents the nonstop march of the day-to-day workflow. So you have a lot of working poor is what that more or less symbolizes. And the three futons are kind of like your rest and relaxation at the end of the workday. Now, that varies, of course, depending on those who decided to have a family of different sizes, but I'm fortunate enough where I chose to not start a family, so I can get my rest and relaxation, which I mostly use up with various projects against the UW system. Of course, that includes this podcast. So as why three futons? Well, many iconic symbols come in trios. So three is just like an archetypal number, so it fits the whole notion of fanciful dreams. And then where was the ramen coming from? Well, that's the odd part, too, is that it appeared to come from an underground chute, which is kind of odd because it's just another odd mystery to a dream. So maybe there's supposed to be like another shoe at the end of the conveyor belt. In that case, why not just have it? Why not just have it plain and clear? But at any rate, there's only so much I can explain about dreams, but I identified the identifiable elements. That is the metaphor of working poor and always being on this this march of workflow, not necessarily a march of progress, but a march of productivity. So the next podcast, WPR Rebuttal, is going to be, Friday, June 17th, and it's going to be at around 12:30, and then I'll have, I'm going to announce the format change because doing half an hour on Friday and doing half an hour on Monday isn't really working out. It's even about as hectic as it was doing a two-hour show on Friday. So I'm just going to have half an hour every Friday. So there will be an official announcement on the site. All right, WPR Rebuttal signing out. Bye.